President Bill Clinton in East Lansing yesterday to accept the inaugural Spartan Statesmanship Award for Distinguished Public Service. This was at the Kellogg Center, with former Michigan Governor Jim Blanchard also on hand. Clinton offered an impassioned defense of public service and of the importance of civic involvement. I will quote here, "In an interdependent world, in an increasingly diverse country, public service cannot and must not be confined to elected officials, full-time government employees, people in the military, and people who work in public safety here at home." Close quote. The award was just before the inaugural Governor Jim Blanchard Public Service Forum here at Michigan State. It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Last week, the 5th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals upheld a lower court ruling to block an extended immigration program the White House enacted in 2012. The court effectively halted the so-called DACA Plus program. Now, the original DACA, which stands for Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, allows children of undocumented immigrants to file for work permits. The extended program would apply to an older group of immigrants. The appeals court ruling now sets the stage for a possible U.S. Supreme Court case that could decide whether President Obama's executive order will stand. We welcome two guests to talk about the implications of the court action. Aida Quadrado is an organizer with the group Action of Greater Lansing. Welcome.
Thank you.
And also joining us today, returning to Current State today, Oscar Castaneda. He's an immigrant from Guatemala who was employed at Michigan State University for some years. He's an expert in geographic information systems, and he's been in East Lansing legally as holder of various visas, including an H-1B and others. His family is subject to the DACA program. Oscar, welcome back.
Thank you very much.
A little background to begin with. The DACA and the DAPA programs were introduced 3 years ago, in August of 2012. What have those programs meant for immigrants here in mid-Michigan? What opportunities have they provided, Aida?
You know, I think, one, it's an opportunity to live in America without fear and anxiety of, you know, being deported at a certain time. But it also gave them access to education and an opportunity to work, right? So that those were like the main two gains from DACA and DAPA. And these are for, you know, young Americans who, young, you know, immigrants, but who consider themselves Americans, who were raised here, who very much probably love the Spartans and, you know, probably go to church on Sundays like we do. And you know, they have access to temporary access to, you know, being able to go to school and to be able to have access to a Social Security card to work. Right.
And we'll point out that the original DACA ruling is still in effect.
Yes.
Now, though, the Fifth Circuit has blocked the implementation of DACA Plus.
Yes.
Which would extend those provisions, those opportunities. The court ruled in favor of the state of Texas specifically, which had claimed that implementation would force it to incur significant costs associated with implementation. Several dozen states supported that move. What opportunities would DACA Plus offer?
You know, it would give an opportunity to not only extend the deferred action, so it would go from 2 years of having access to the visa and staying here in the United States. So deferred action from removal, right? And you don't have to worry about for another year. So moving it from 2 years to 3 years, and it was also including DACA Plus was DAPA, right? So we're also talking about parents of Americans, right?
Are these new opportunities, or are the same opportunities that were in DACA just extended?
So for DACA, the first program, DACA, yes, it's extended. For DAPA, which is for parents of Americans,
that's an expansion,
is the first one. But DAPA for parents of parents of Americans is actually new. We're talking about parents who have children who were born here in America.
And Oscar, you visited us on Current State about a year ago. At the time, you had lost your work permit and your position here at Michigan State University. Remind us briefly, if you can, how that happened and what has occurred to you in the years since. You were here legally on an H-1B visa, but your family was impacted by the DACA ruling.
My children came under my visa because they were under 21 at the time. When my kids came to America, they were 2 and 3 years old. So for any practical purposes, they feel that they behave like Americans, and they've been here their whole lives.
And they were here legally as a result of the H-1B.
Under my visas, exactly. Okay. 1 year ago, exactly 1 year ago, my working permit expired and they didn't renew it. And I am appealing. I've been appealing that decision. And because I don't have a working permit, I cannot work at MSU. My children went to... They went to high school in East Lansing, and they did the whole education in East Lansing. They were always very good students, and they never caused any kind of problems. Then they went to college. They both went to college. Because they are not American citizens, they cannot apply for student aid. So I paid their college education with my own money, never borrowed any money, never got any free money. And now they both are college educated, and they did very well in college. So if it wasn't because of DACA, they wouldn't be allowed to work.
What does the fact that DACA Plus has not been implemented, has that impacted you and your family?
No, it hasn't, because they are still getting benefit from the initial DACA. But I can see the problems for so many people who didn't have time to apply for DACA one. Mm-hmm. And this is one piece. And this is the idea of all these young people who... There are so many people who has been very successful in America. There are guys who already went to Iraq and fought in Iraq and Afghanistan. And now they come back and they don't have documents and they don't have nothing to do in this country. Mm-hmm. So...
Aida, tell me about how the failure to implement DACA Plus is implementing other people that you serve at Action of Greater Lansing.
You know, when the President of the United States announced that the executive action for DACA and DAPA Plus, it gave hope to, like, families, right? Because when we're looking at the situation of a possible student, a parent of an American, you know, we're talking about a family unit. So it gave it was going to give them access to deferred action for a certain amount of years, right? So they can live here in America together, not worrying about being separated. So there's the implications of possibly, you know, being separated. It's not, you know, now parents don't have that access. Now the child would have to wait till they're 21 to petition the United States court to see if they can have a parent stay here as a permanent resident or bring them in, right? So, and then also those who didn't qualify, who weren't bought over or weren't here by the age of 16, I believe, won't also. So, and we don't, it's all in the air. You have to understand that all of this is all in the air because of the fact that it was an executive action.
But understood. And there's a the legal debate,
yes.
The legal dispute that is in play here is whether or not the president has the legal authority in an executive order to enforce immigration policy. The courts have ruled against that, as they did again last week. So legally, that is the dispute.
Mm-hmm.
Are you saying that deportation is more likely for some number of Lansing undocumented immigrants if DACA Plus is not implemented? Is there a greater chance of deportation as long as that is not implemented?
You know what? I would say things could either stay the same depending on what happens with this new legislature that's come in with Congress and the Senate. I would say that I think hope and people's, you know, desire and wishes for the future of what could possibly be if they had access to a temporary stay here in the United States changes drastically. I think Oscar could probably answer that a little bit better. I mean, he would be somebody that would be impacted by DACA and DAPA. So,
anything to add, Oscar?
I'm not really sure if it's gonna increase the possibility of being deported in the short term, but it means that you're gonna have people with education who cannot work. It means that you're gonna have people who is living here and they don't have a driver's license. It means that you have people who is not gonna be contributing to the economy. So providing this temporary relief, because it's not a blank card to go and stay here forever. It's temporary. until they get until somebody takes a final action and they decide what to do with all the undocumented immigrants.
How are you going to feel about this if it goes to the Supreme Court? Have you anticipated what the Supreme Court is likely to do with this?
I don't think that nobody knows. What I do know is that so far it has been a political game. Mm-hmm. They were very selective about where they filed their case, and they were very selective about where they took it and the circuit that they took it. And what is going to happen in the Supreme Court, which is the maximum authority, nobody knows. And I keep reading, and it's up in the air.
Yeah, and when you're looking at, you know, the President of the United States, who is a constitutional law professor, I'm hoping that the Supreme Court votes in favor of the families, right? That this is within the legal powers of the executive branch. It would be kind of sad to hear that, you know, this is just like a political stunt just from, you know, the president's cabinet to, you know, get immigrants excited about the possibility of having a deferred action. But even with that, even with, you know, the Supreme Court passing this, it's still not a pathway to citizenship for many immigrants here in the United States. Right.
And something that people doesn't know is that the president has been taking executive actions in immigration issues for many years. Mm-hmm. Many presidents took executive actions before to provide relief to people who has been affected by sudden political changes for natural disasters. It's not a new thing. Mm-hmm. It's just now that they make it a big deal.
We're talking about a recent federal court ruling that would block two Obama administration immigration programs. They are the so-called DAPA and DACA Plus plans. Joining us in Studio S today, Aida Quadrado with Action of Greater Lansing. Also, Oscar Castaneda, a former Michigan State University employee who immigrated here from Guatemala. How often, Aida, does the deportation of a mid-Michigan undocumented immigrant happen right now? Is it a common occurrence? Is it on hold? What?
It's definitely a common occurrence, you know, depending on, you know, where you're at in Michigan, the political nature of your city. We were blessed that, you know, the Lansing area said that we know we're a welcoming city and that, you know, we're not in the process of ripping, you know, we're not in the business of ripping families apart, but, you know, definitely looking at those who are might have committed a crime as high priority, right?
Oscar, what are you and your family's plans right now? What are you doing in this period?
I am in limbo, which is the worst part of it. I'm waiting to hear from the last appeal that I sent to court, and it might take forever. It's taking a long time.
What's the grounds for your appeal? The fact that you are settled in the United States, you've been here legally for many years.
No, it doesn't have any value. The grounds for my they don't want to give me a permanent residency because in 1993, I came with a J-1 visa. And this J-1 visa technically required for me to go back for 2 years. And I went back, and then I was invited to come back, and I applied for a visa again, and they gave it to me. And then when I asked for a working permit, they gave it to me. So now they are saying, you were supposed to go back in 1993. Mm. And because I never did these 2 years, they won't give me permanent residency. So what I am appealing is, I ask for a waiver for those 2 years. Mm-hmm. And they said no, and I'm appealing that decision.
But your case is somewhat unique.
Yes.
In a way. Mm-hmm. What are Action of Greater Lansing's next steps, Aida? What are you doing during this period?
You know, absolutely. We have to have these tough conversations in communities who are not familiar with what's going on with DACA and DAPA. You know, these are young adults, right? These are youth that I consider, you know, right before college, high school students who have to prove that they're either going to college or joining the military. You know, they have to pass extensive background. So one, it's educating the community. But you know, not knowledge without action is powerless, right? So we gotta look at how do we hold our elected officials accountable? How do we have these conversations? And I know that across the nation, there's going to be a national day of action around DACA and DAPA to bring, you know,
attention. When is that? Do we know?
they're looking at December 10th right now. So it'll be during that week that they're going to be doing state. I know here in state of Michigan, we'll probably be participating in, you know, you're going to be looking at actions happening in Kalamazoo, Grand Rapids, across the state and across the nation.
We have to leave it there. We've been talking about a federal appeals court's decision to uphold an injunction against President Obama's DAPA and DACA Plus immigration plans. Aida Quadrado is an organizer with Action of Greater Lansing. Oscar Castaneda is an immigrant from Guatemala and former Michigan State University employee. Thank you both for your time today. Well, this year, all this year, the Grand Rapids Symphony has been looking for a new music director, and this weekend they're bringing in a director who has a program which is, very unfortunately, a timely one. Current State's Jamie Paisley joins me now after speaking with the maestro. Hi, Jamie.
Hi, Mark. I spoke with Runa Bergman about this weekend's Grand Rapids Symphony concerts, which are indeed thematic. Most of the concerts will be devoted to Brahms' Requiem. And the remaining two works are similar classical works, which were written in honor of those that have departed. Given the news still kind of rolling in from Paris and Beirut, Maestro Runa Bergman said prepping for these upcoming concerts in Grand Rapids was particularly eerie. And to begin the concert, Maestro Bergman turns to the Finnish conductor Jean Sibelius and the work In Memoriam, which was written when Sibelius was 45, about halfway through his life.
In the way it ended up for himself, actually, it was played in his funeral. I mean, there was, at the time, it was a very difficult time with Russia. I could even feel it so many years after this conflict and all the problems that there was still this very cold relationship between Finland and Russia. Even though I didn't live in those days and could see what happened, you can kind of really feel that this was something that the Finns didn't appreciate at all. So basically, it started writing is for kind of a requiem for a man called Schaumann. He was the one that shot one of the Russians that were kind of the boss of Finland at the time. It probably wasn't politically correct at all to do something like that, and maybe he could be even punished for it. So he later said that, no, it was just in memory of something. So the story behind this is a little bit confusing. Also, it's kind of typical Sibelius from actually the first note that is played. You can kind of hear the colors. The nature, many composers are influenced by the nature, but Sibelius, you can always hear this really dark Finnish woods.
Joining the Sibelius In Memoriam during this week's Grand Rapids Symphony Concert with conductor Runa Bergman is another work which serves as a tribute, but in this instance, the minimalist Estonian composer Arvo Pärt, in his piece Cantus In Memoriam Benjamin Britten, uses musical structure in a very interesting way. Specifically,
how to make scale go downwards. But then the other voices around this minor scale that goes down, he uses in the other voices the same scale, but in the half tempo. And he just plays this scale in a different place every time. So you can't feel the structure, but there is a very clear structure about this. I think he was just very sad that he didn't get the chance to meet Benjamin Britten That seemed to be a very big dream of him that came too late. So that probably just inspired him to do something similar. Like, even though it doesn't sound like Britten at all, he wanted to write something very clean and clear.
And after that minimalist work by Arvo Pärt, as well as the Sibelius Memoriam, conductor Rune Bergman will spend the bulk of this weekend's Grand Rapids Symphony Concert at DeVos Hall with one of the landmark works of the Romantic era, the German Requiem by Johannes Brahms. Typically, though, playing three works, all of which were composed in memory of another who has passed on, is certainly an oddity for any concert hall.
For me, it's very unusual to do concert with just tragic music in a way. And the two first ones is more about the memory. But with the Brahms, even though it's memory and death and all that, it's still, I find more hope, actually, in that piece. He's hoping for something better and something great.
Now, what makes Brahms' Requiem a more German Requiem? Well, for Johannes Brahms, he considered this a humanist Requiem, so he didn't use the traditional liturgical text, you know, using the Dies Irae, the Sanctus, Benedictus, or even the Agnus Dei.
Traditionally, there was used this Catholic Mass before, and that's what we know best from all kinds of Requiems. I think that in the same way, Brahms was personally involved in this. He lost his mother. I think he just took texts that he liked and found comfort or found interesting. For many, that is probably feels strange. In another way, that is what I find very interesting and very honest in this work, that he used the text that makes sense for his way of feelings and writing. Brahms had a very complicated life, I think, both within love and many things. And those kinds of problems have made great composers of all times. But Brahms is very special. He's one of my favorites because I find his writing so open and honest. Time, I think he felt pressure coming from Haydn, Mozart, Beethoven, and those structured symphonies. He had a big struggle how to continue after Beethoven, in a way. So I think that this work is kind of his way through this freedom, because it's kind of written even before his first symphony. So it's very impressive how he orchestrates.
This weekend's Grand Rapids Symphony Concert was programmed far in advance. Guest conductor Rune Bergman is certainly aware of the power that these three classical works has, since the Sibelius, the Pärt, and the Brahms were composed in remembrance of those lost.
I mean, it was kind of strange sitting and preparing for this program. Unfortunately, it happens too much bad things every day, but I mean, this concert will be 1 week after the tragedy in Paris, so I think we all need to hope for a better world soon.
Conductor Rune Bergman, who will be joining the Grand Rapids Symphony both Friday and Saturday evening at 8 p.m. in the DeVos Performance Hall of Grand Rapids. Also, Bergman is one of the finalists of the Grand Rapids Symphony's search for a new music director. which has been and will be ongoing during this 2015-16 concert season. Tickets and more information about this concert, anchored by the Brahms Requiem, is available at grsymphony.org. For Current State, I'm Jamie Paisley.
Coming up on Current State, a group of transgender individuals says Michigan's policies when it comes to changing their driver's licenses and state IDs are unconstitutional. A U.S. district judge denied the state's request to dismiss the lawsuit earlier this week. We talked with one of the plaintiffs in the case, Tina Seitz, as well as Jay Kaplan, staff attorney for ACLU Michigan's LGBT project. Plus, this unseasonably warm November might have you wondering, where's the snow and when might it come? We'll check in with MLive's chief meteorologist, Mark Torregrossa, about what the warm fall weather means for our winter forecast. That and more after the break. That is saxophonist Vincent Bowens playing a song for my son on a Live Music Friday earlier this year here on Current State. Tomorrow on Live Music Friday, we welcome back local blues fixture Twyla Birdsong, who won this year's Capital Area Blues Society competition. Twyla Birdsong tomorrow on Current State's Live Music Friday. We hope you can join us for that. Current State, three times every weekday on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. We're always at WKAR.org. You need a driver's license for a lot of things, perhaps for even grabbing a drink after work, or certainly going through the security check at an airport. But some transgender people in Michigan say the state makes it impossible for them to get accurate state IDs. Michigan requires that the gender listed on a state ID match a person's birth certificate. Those challenging the policy say it requires them to provide private medical information and puts them at risk of harassment and violence. They're suing Secretary of State Ruth Johnson for allegedly violating their constitutional rights. The state's motion to dismiss the lawsuit was denied earlier this week by U.S. District Judge Nancy Edmonds, here to talk about what's at stake in the case. It's one of the plaintiffs, Tina Seitz, as well as Jay Kaplan, the staff attorney for the ACLU of Michigan's LGBT project. Tina, Jay, welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. Jay, let's start with you. Can you lay out what the Secretary of State's policy is when it comes to changing your gender on a state ID card, like a driver's license?
Yes, the Secretary of State's policy is in order to change the gender on a license or a state ID, you first have to change the gender on your birth certificate. So it means different things depending on what state you were born in. If you were born in Michigan, it means that you have to provide proof that you've undergone some form of gender reassignment surgery. Other states, like Ohio and Tennessee and Idaho, they don't allow gender changes on birth certificates under any circumstance. Some other states have no requirement of surgery to change the gender on a birth certificate. Some states require you have to go to that state and get a court adjudication of your gender before you can change the gender on your birth certificate. So it creates various classes of people depending on what state that you were born in because it relies on the birth certificate.
So we're all over the place from state to state then, I guess.
We are.
Tina, talk to us about your experience trying to get your gender changed on your driver's license.
I was told that I could not get the gender changed to match who I am because I had to provide a birth certificate to prove who I was. And since I was born in the state of Ohio, it lists me as male. And the reality is that the birth certificate is a living document that I need through my life, but Ohio honors it as a snapshot in time. So that's their reasoning for not changing it ever. But due to that, when I applied for the driver's license, the state of Michigan told me that there was no way that I would be able to have female on my driver's license. And that's also mirrored in their policy with state IDs also.
I take it you're not saying that it's inappropriate for that information to be on a state ID, or are you?
Yes, I am saying it's inappropriate because it doesn't match who I am, and it does put me at risk of harassment violence.
No, I'm asking, is it inappropriate to have any indication of gender or sex on a driver's license or state ID?
Well, why don't I try to answer that? I
sure.
think most states do have that. I don't know necessarily that we would argue that it's that it's essential to have one's gender on their driver's license or state ID. But nevertheless, the reality is that states do adhere to that practice. The problem with Michigan's policy, which by the way is an outlier, when you look at the majority of the states, they don't have any such requirement like this, nor does the federal government have that requirement for a passport or for Social Security records. The problem is you have people in Michigan, a majority of transgender people, who can't obtain accurate identity documents, and every time they have to show that driver's license or that state ID, they're showing something that is isn't congruent with their gender appearance and mm-hmm. their gender identity, and it also forces them to disclose highly private and personal information about who they are.
Mm-hmm. Jay Kaplan is the staff attorney for the ACLU of Michigan's LGBT Project, an attorney in the Love v. Johnson lawsuit, which is challenging Michigan's policies on gender identification on state IDs. We're also joined by Tina Seitz, one of the plaintiffs in the lawsuit. And Tina, I take it there have been specific instances in which being identified as male on your driver's license has created problems for you. Is that right?
That most definitely, yes.
Can you talk about any of those?
One particular instance, when I was going through an airport, I did have an individual, one of the TSA agents, try and intimidate me, both with his demeanor and with his attitude towards me. He did not actually do anything violent against me, but it was very evident that he did not approve of who I was, and it put me in fear where I was very curious as to were they going to pull me aside to put me through extra scrutiny? Were they going to make it so that I missed my flight? And these types of issues do happen more often than they should. And most recently in Orlando, there was a trans woman that was denied access, and eventually they kicked her out of the airport because she tried to film the incident.
Jay, we did reach out to Secretary of State Ruth Johnson's office. Her office declined to comment on the ongoing litigation, but spokesperson Fred Woodhams said in an email that, quote, the department is following state law and is required to verify identity information, including the sex of an individual, unquote. Jay Kaplan, any particular response to that?
I say the word disingenuous. We have more than 30 states that do not have this kind of requirement, do not have any kind of surgery requirement. There is nothing in the law, in Michigan law, that requires the Secretary of State to have this policy, and her office knows that. As a result of this policy, you have the majority of transgender people going around with inaccurate identity documents that are incongruent with what their passport might say, what their Social Security records might say, and incongruent with their gender appearance and their gender identity. So that doesn't make any sense. It's a circular answer that doesn't have any basis in reality. Michigan's policy is completely an outlier when you look at what other states are doing. We probably have the worst policy in the country, and that makes it virtually impossible for people to get accurate identity documents.
I mean, I know the state has also responded, Jay, though, that the policy promotes better law enforcement and it makes sure that information is consistent across state documents. How do you respond to that argument?
Well, for instance, if you're applying for a driver's license for the first time and you're transgender, you don't have to produce your birth certificate. So you have some transgender individuals who the first time they got their license, they have accurate identity. Then you have transgender people who, after they've transitioned, who have gone to Michigan and can't get the proper ID, so they have inaccurate identity documents. And then you have people, transgender people, whose passport says one thing, whose Social Security records say one thing, and their Michigan ID says something else. It doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense at all. You have other people who were born in states like California to change their birth certificate. There's no surgery requirement, and so it's an inconsistent policy. It's a troublesome policy. It's a flawed policy, and it does nothing to ensure that you have consistency with identity documents. And with regarding law enforcement, if there's any, you know, they brought up the issue about if someone's to be incarcerated. Well, the federal law, the Prison Rape Prevention Act, specifically says that when you are dealing with transgender inmates, you have to, on an individual basis, make a determination on where you house them. You don't just go by what someone's driver's license or what someone's state's ID says. So I'm not buying it. We're not buying it.
Jay Kaplan is the staff attorney for the ACLU of Michigan's LGBT Project and an attorney in the Love v. Johnson lawsuit, which is challenging Michigan's policies on gender identification on state IDs. We're also joined by Tina Seitz, one of the plaintiffs on the lawsuit. Can you talk to us a little bit more about the private medical information? I mean, you argue that it obliges you to put private medical information out there that you should not be obliged to provide. Talk to us about that.
Sure. Well, Tina goes to the grocery store, and she is using her credit card, and the cashier asked her to present her driver's license that says that she's male. So to that cashier, perfect stranger, all of a sudden medical information is disclosed for the fact that Tina's transgender, that she has been diagnosed with a condition called gender dysphoria, meaning that her gender identity is incongruent with what her gender was assigned to her at the time of birth. Private medical information that I don't have to go through when I have to when I show my driver's license to use my credit card at the grocery store. Mm.
Tina, when you talk to people about why you're suing the state, what do you say exactly? How do you frame this?
One of the main issues that I'm concerned about within the transgender community is the lack of resources that we have as far as gaining employment. And we have to prove who we are at such time that we accept the position. And this is one of the reasons that the transgender community is so underemployed or unemployed, is they show a document that says something other than who they are. And because of that, they're unable to get a job. So this affects our livelihoods along with the privacy and our safety issues.
Jay, are you confident you'll win this battle?
We are confident. We think we've raised some very cognizable legal claims. Certainly the judge, in denying the state's motion to dismiss, focused on the privacy issue.
What will change? We've got just 30 seconds. What will change if you win?
Well, hopefully the Secretary of State will have to change her policy. You know, this is not a law. Unilaterally, with a stroke of the pen, she can change this policy. There's no legislative approval or anything. It's really all up to her office to make this change. And hopefully a successful outcome will get that change.
Jay Kaplan, staff attorney with ACLU of Michigan's LGBT Project and an attorney in the Love v. Johnson lawsuit. We also heard from Tina Seitz. One of the plaintiffs in the lawsuit. Thank you very much for joining us. Good luck.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Before in a driving machine. This is the SS350 with rally sport equipment, wicked black grille, and a fuselage that bulges around its 350 cubic inch V8 engine. Shaped for action, all the way back to its sporty rear deck.
Well, nearly a half century after it first rolled off the Michigan line, the Chevy Camaro is going as strong as ever. General Motors snapped up one of the two top honors for Motor Trend magazine this week, as the Camaro was named Motor Trend Car of the Year, while the mid-sized Chevy Colorado was named Truck of the Year by Motor Trend. And as many of you know, Camaro is now made right here in Lansing. So congratulations, especially to all of you Camaro builders here in the capital city. I'm Mark Bayshore. This is Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Well, right around this time last year, nearly half of Michigan was covered in snow. So what's different about 2015 than about 2014? Joining us by phone to answer that question is Mark Terragrossa, chief meteorologist at MLive and at farmerweather.com. Mark, welcome back to Current State.
Hey, good morning.
What do you attribute the difference between this November and last November?
Well, last year we had a very cold pocket of air that had been dominating our weather for several years, and it had already invaded our area. This year, we've stuck with a south-southwest wind for most of November. That's a real rare flow for November, and we've had a very mild November. If you want to attribute it to anything, it may be attributable to El Nino, but I think that the warming effects of El Nino really don't show up until late December and into the heart of winter. So this I would just call an anomalously warm pattern.
Remind our listeners what El Nino is.
El Nino is when the Pacific Ocean between South America and Australia warms up more than normal. And it happens on a cyclical pattern, not something that's so cyclical we can say this year will be an El Nino, next year won't, and that year will be an El Nino. But it is warmed up, and right now, currently, we have the second strongest El Nino ever in modern history since 1950. And it's pacing that it probably will be the strongest El Nino in modern history.
How about that? Every time this discussion comes up, I'm recalling Christmas Day of 1982. It hit around 65 degrees on Christmas Day here in the Lansing area. It was an extraordinary day. But you're saying this El Nino we're looking at is on par to be the second strongest since 1950?
Currently, it is the second strongest. And as it continues to pace, the forecast in the next month or two probably will bring it to officially being termed the strongest El Nino. And you're right. You remember Christmas Day of 82. And that's when typically the warmer than normal, I don't want to use the word warm for winter. I want to use the words warmer than normal weather starts to show up and makes us in Michigan sense like, hey, this is going to be a little bit different of a winter than normal. Right now we feel that because we've been warm in November, but typically we don't think the El Nino effects affect this part of the year, but it's hard to say too. But as we get toward the last week of December and you look at the extended forecast in the first 2 weeks of January, if you see milder than normal temperatures forecast and quieter weather patterns, not as much storming as forecast, you can probably be rest assured that El Nino is the maker of that, we'll say.
Mark Terragrossa is chief meteorologist at MLive and at farmerweather.com. Now, you mentioned that we probably won't see the effects of the El Nino, I beg your pardon, until late next month. But the peak of those effects are December and January, or are we apt to see the effects of an El Nino all the way to mid-March?
Peak of those effects would be late December, January, February, March, and possibly April.
Remind us what La Nina is here, too, and how it relates to El Nino.
Okay, La Nina is the opposite, when the ocean all of a sudden starts to cool off more than normal. And a La Nina tends to bring us a little bit better of a chance of a cold and snowy winter. But the big factor that I think we watch for is when an El Nino starts to cool, like it's forecast in the spring or summer of next year, and if it cools rapidly and sinks right into a La Nina, pattern, which happens sometimes. It's a hot, dry pattern that typically shows up in the Corn Belt, just off to our west, Iowa, Illinois, Missouri, Nebraska, Wisconsin, Minnesota, and the heat spreads this way. So we could be looking at an about face on the weather that we've had the last two or three years, cold and snowy, to a mild and less snow type winter, to if the El Nino fades, La Nina kicks in, we may transition right into a hotter summer.
Hmm. It looks like we could get some snowfall this weekend. Is that right?
Yeah, it is. I'm writing a post right now for MLive, and we're just going to be following this. And right now I'm covering what we do know and what we don't know about the storm. What we do know is it's coming on Saturday, starting early Saturday morning in the southwest side of the state, sweeping across the state during the day on Saturday and ending Sunday night. The temperatures, in my mind, are just going to be marginal for snow. I do think we're going to have a lot of wet snow falling at times. You can expect your first winter driving conditions, but the roads are warm. The ground is super warm. The Great Lakes have not cooled off at all. They're averaging 45 to 50 degrees. All of those things, I think, are going to take half of the snow that falls in the sky and melt it on the ground. And right now, what we don't know is exactly how much snow falls at your house by Sunday morning.
But given what you've said about the rest of the winter, the odds that it'll stick sound pretty slim. Will it be around for Thanksgiving? Will it stick around that long if it snows?
No, it won't. We're already going to be back into a southwest wind by Monday and Tuesday of next week. We're going to start a warming trend as we head toward Thanksgiving. Right now, Thanksgiving looks like temperatures would be well above freezing, so any travel around the Great Lakes wouldn't have to worry about any of the white stuff or ice. And then as we get to past Thanksgiving, it looks like another little blast of cold could come, and we may have to deal with snow and ice on the return trip after Thanksgiving.
All right. A nice summary of where we're at and a nice look ahead. We've been talking about Michigan's winter weather with Mark Torregrossa, chief meteorologist at MLive and at farmerweather.com. Mark, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Geography awareness was created by presidential proclamation during the Reagan administration to help young Americans better understand their roles as global citizens. Michigan State University plays the lead role in Geo Week here in mid-Michigan, and Current State is also presenting several discussions on WKAR related to geographic awareness in a week-long series. Today, MSU Assistant Professor Elizabeth Mack weighs in on how the field of geography is commonly misunderstood and why we're taking this week to try to understand it more.
Well, we celebrate Geography Awareness Week because a lot of people are unaware of what geographers do.
Yeah.
And I usually get confused with geologists. That happened during a game of Trivial Pursuit.
Geography for $300, that's a blue wedge. Jamie, you're in control.
Someone said, well, you know about rocks.
How often does that happen?
Very frequently.
Really?
Yes.
Happened during Trivial Pursuit.
Are you ready to play Trivial Pursuit?
Trivial Pursuit. Yeah. Well, here's a question about rocks. You must know something about that. And I said, well, not particularly.
Right.
Or people assume that geography is the ability, you know, to do very well on Jeopardy.
What is Dakar, capital of Senegal?
Name a lot of rivers and mountains,
right.
And, and countries that obscure countries, and it is those things,
right.
But it's so much more. And so I tell people, particularly in the area of, where you live in an era of big data, user-generated data, where a lot of the information that people are providing, if you check in on Foursquare or you look at someone's map on that someone has created on Facebook, for example, these are all sort of geographic digital data that people are creating.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the issues with these data is data quality.
Mm-hmm.
And also biases maybe in who is producing this information and the reason that this information is being produced. And so I think the ability to see data, as I said before, provides sort of a new ground for inquiry.
Yeah.
And then you begin to ask questions about how was this produced? Why was this produced? And so geography is about the where, but also explaining how and why.
Dr. Elizabeth Mack from the Department of Geography, thanks very much for being with us on Current State today.
Thank you.
For Current State, this is Peter Worf.
And that's our show for today. Glad you could join us. Friday on Current State, the Lansing Board of Water and Light releases its final report this evening covering the changes at the utility since the 2013 ice storm. We'll discuss what's in the report with BWL Commissioner David Price. We'll also be joined by General Michael McDaniel, who led the BWL Community Review Team that explored the utility's response to the storm and proposed many of the reforms. Plus, it's another Live Music Friday. Our guest this week is Twyla Birdsong, winner of this year's Capital Area Blues Competition. All that and more Friday on Current State. Our executive producer is Peter Worf. Thanks to April Van Buren, who directed our show today. Thanks as well to Scott Pohl, Kevin Lavery, Katie Cook, Jamie Paisley, and Drew Hill. We're a podcast, too. Don't forget, get it daily to your smartphone. Subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're feeling generous, maybe throw some stars our way. You can also connect with us on social media, on Twitter, at KAR Current State, on Facebook, Current State from WKAR. Thanks for joining us. See you tomorrow. It's Current State on WKAR.